From WXXI News, I'm Jasmine Singer, and this is Environmental Connections. Today's Environmental Connection began last summer when I stood in my living room surrounded by bags of clothes that I had decided to donate. I felt good about decluttering. I thought I was making a positive impact. They didn't bring me joy anymore, as Marie Kondo would say. But after some research, I was dismayed to learn that a huge portion of donated clothes ends up in landfills or shipped overseas where they can harm local economies and environments. And this moment of realization, whoa, it led me to really deep dive into this issue, to open my eyes to what I learned was the hidden costs of fast fashion. And, you know, the environmental impact of fast fashion, it's really staggering, with the industry responsible for massive textile waste and extensive water usage and significant pollution. These practices strain our natural resources, contributing to climate change and ecological imbalance. In response to these challenges, there are various initiatives and movements emerging that promote sustainable fashion, from circular fashion models and upcycling initiatives to regenerative agriculture. The fashion industry needs a transformative shift towards sustainability and accountability. Today, we're going to explore these aspects in depth. We're going to look at how donated clothes are managed, the role of thrift stores, including online ones, and how consumer behavior can drive change. We'll also discuss practical steps for greening your wardrobe and the future trends in sustainable fashion. To help us unpack these issues and provide insights, I am so excited to welcome our guests, Kate Walker and Marissa Adler. Kate Walker is the Executive Director of the Center for Sustainable Materials Management. Thank you so much for joining me in the studio again, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me.
I love picking your brain. I'm always grateful when I have the opportunity to. And Marissa Adler is a senior consultant with Resource Recycling Systems, RRS, where she leads the textile circularity practice. And she's joining us by phone today. Welcome, Marissa.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I am so intrigued by the work you're doing. I'm not even sure what it means, textile circularity practice. Actually, let's start with that. What does that mean exactly, Marissa?
So I'm a senior consultant with a circular economy consulting firm, RRS, and our objective is to find solutions to managing the materials that we generate as waste and that we use in our daily lives, to keep them in circulation as long as possible. And so I focus in particular on textiles as a product category and material category. And my goals with the textile circularity practice are really just to help advance systems change so that we can proactively recover more of the textiles that Americans are generating as waste every day and every year and feed those into useful end markets such as reuse, recycling, repurposing. So that's really what I'm focused on.
Okay, great. Because, you know, there's so much about this subject that I don't know about. I mean, it's selfish of me to want to explore this topic because I'm fascinated by all of it. But like, I don't know what greenwashing is when it comes to sustainable fashion. Mm. And so let's dig into that a little bit. But Kate, I want to understand a little bit more about what you do at the Center for Sustainable Materials Management. What's its mission?
Yeah.
What's your mission?
Yeah, thank you so much for providing the opportunity to share more about our center. So the center was founded in 2019, and we are housed at SUNY ESF, so right down the street in Syracuse, New York. And our mission is to inspire, lead, and connect a diverse group of people, organizations, businesses all across New York State that collectively challenge the concept of waste as an idea, right? The fact that waste shouldn't be a thing, right? Everything is from energy. We should be able to pretty much save and repurpose everything. So redefining and reimagining how we procure, produce, consume, manage, and then market those materials. You'll hear a lot of similarities between what Marissa and I do, but what's really unique about the center is that we're partnering research and academic institutions across New York State and emerging new technology and innovations and pairing that, hopefully, in everyday lives. So through municipal work, in the private sector, making those connections and hopefully also feeding those great lessons learned to future policy. So we're really in the middle of all of these places, and it's been such a delight to work with RRS and to work with Marissa on a couple of our textile projects. So Jasmine, it was a little bit selfish on my own part. Textiles are complex. I think every single one of us, when we look at our wardrobes and look at, you know, we want to look good, we want to buy new stuff, but it's hard to really figure this out. So so excited to start this conversation.
Yeah, I often say that food is the most personal political issue there is. And it is, but gosh, clothing is too, isn't it? It's our self-expression. It's how we show up in the world. It speaks for so much about like who we are, or it can. I guess it can. I mean, I think that these are issues that a lot of people haven't necessarily given thought to as much as, for example, you know, food or insert the blank. But but you're, what you wear, am I right, Kate, that it really does reflect, it can really reflect how you're showing up for the planet.
100%. And it's so interesting that that was one of the first things that you just said in preparation for today and thinking about textiles. I thought about food, right? I thought about the work that we're doing in diverting food and the complexity, not only one, like you said, Jasmine, it's so personal, these decisions that we, of what we wear, but on the end, in the end market, and when we get to the end of life of this material, you know, like food, you can put it in your in a compost, right? Yes, it's a complex system to break down, but what we're learning about textiles at the end of life is that they are much more complicated, and we need to figure out how to manage those. So really interesting that you brought that up, because I think we need to understand a little bit more about what our clothing is made of, and it will help and inform a consumer, hopefully, to make a better choice for the planet.
So what are the major environmental issues associated with fast fashion, especially in terms of textile waste and pollution, Kate?
Well, I'd say the biggest piece, which I think you'd have to be living under a rock to not know, is generally we just have, there's overproduction, right? So compared to, I think there's many figures out there, but from 2000 to 2020, we've almost doubled the production of textiles. So I'm looking right at fashion has doubled. So we have just so much more material. And again, where is that material ending up? Like all of our materials management, where are these things ending up? They're going to landfill, a good percentage of them. They're being shipped out of country. And that has an enormous impact, obviously, on greenhouse gas emissions. And when we think about our larger climate goals, we need to think about, first of all, how much we're producing. That's going to have an impact on water, soil, energy, all of these things that when we dive into climate plans, we need to reduce the amount that we're using. So I would say overproduction. I'd like to see what Marissa wants to add too. She probably has some additions.
Marissa, I'd love to know if you have any additions, as Kate said. And also, I'm curious how the industry's significant water usage affects our natural resources when it comes to textiles.
Overproduction, I agree with Kate, is really the leading concern when you're looking at textiles. It flows down through use and then end of life and second use. And I sort of sit at the back end, that end of life point. But the value of taking something at end of life and finding new ways to put it back into economic use really immediately addresses that overproduction issue. Because if you're using more secondhand and you're recirculating finished products for multiple uses, and you're recovering the materials and recycling them to create new textiles, then you're really offsetting the need for initial and production use by extracting raw materials from the environment and from our natural resources. So I would say that there's a big impact upstream in the textile production. And that's where the majority of the environmental impact occurs in the textile supply chain. But if you're managing the end of life and managing the things that we've already produced, we produce over 100 billion items of textile garments every year. And when you think about the scale of that, and then you remember that we only have 8 billion people on Earth. I say only, but you have 8 billion people on Earth, and every year that growth in the production is increasing and increasing because we're always chasing growth and chasing the bottom line. It really is a concerning effect when you look at the whole thing from thousands of view.
That is Marissa Adler. If you're just tuning in, Marissa is a senior consultant with Resource Recycling Systems, where she leads RRS's textile circularity practice. And we're also joined in the studio today by Kate Walker, the executive director of the Center for Sustainable Materials Management. I'm Jasmine Singer. This is Environmental Connections. The last Friday of every month, we kind of, you know, shove Evan over and discuss gently, of course, and discuss climate-related issues that impact you. So listeners, just a reminder, we want to hear from you too. We're discussing textiles and clothing and how that relates to climate change. So if you have a question for either of my guests, please call in 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. If you're local, you can call 263-9994. And you can also email us at connections@wxxi.org. So as we started to talk about, your organizations are doing incredible work in managing materials more sustainably. So Kate, can you share some innovative ways you're addressing these challenges here in New York?
I think that they're innovative, anyone working in sustainability recognizes that the first step of any project, whether you're, you know, within a manufacturing setting and you're redesigning or, you know, remanufacturing something, the first part is really data analysis.
Wow. I don't think of that when I put on my dress.
So I'd like to think that this is innovative. And I think as I mentioned, the formation of the center and the fact that we're an organization that's sitting in between policy, academic research, and all of these and this great private sector connections that are innovating brand new technology. But the first step, and what we realize as we dive into textiles, is that no one really has a great handle of the scale of the problem, specifically in New York, right? So when you dive in, the first step is to understand the waste problem in the very beginning. So, I think it's now 2 years ago, Marissa and RRS and the center started a project in New York State, and we are collaborating on understanding to really dive into not only what that waste stream looks like, but also consumer behavior. What are New York State consumers, what are they understanding about textile waste and where it goes? From the private sector, what is happening boots on the ground, and what are the needs in terms of potential infrastructure investments? Because again, those are going to be that's the critical information for advising and creating great policy in New York State. So I'd love to kick it to Marissa to talk a little bit more about that project, because she can dive in a little too.
Yeah, I'm intrigued. Marissa, tell us about it.
There are major data gaps in our knowledge about the textile waste infrastructure and ecosystem altogether. We can't really pinpoint, our recovery rate, for example, how much textile waste that's generated every year is actually recovered for reuse and recycling. The EPA does evaluation of waste and diversion rates and recycling rates. They estimate about 15%. That is largely informed by input from industry associations like the Secondary Materials and Recycled Textiles Association, as well as looking at levels of production, import and export. And the export code that they look at covers used clothing. And so they are capturing that used clothing, but only the values that are exported. But when it comes to textiles, we know that a lot of the reuse happens outside of that formal collection sector. Mm. So we have a lot of peer-to-peer sharing. We have a lot of online marketplaces. We have a lot of donation to thrift that then gets turned around and sold back to the local community. We have garage sales and lots of other ways that we move and reuse our textiles that don't necessarily make it into the official numbers. And we really have no idea how big that market is. And so it's really hard to say with certainty how good we are at reusing and recycling our textiles. And so that data point is something that we have been trying to pin down by doing a lot of infrastructure mapping and stakeholder interviews and really understanding the movement of the textiles within a community.
Marissa, my wife has started to unravel fast fashion thrifted sweaters to obtain yarn for knit and crochet projects. She gets them at the Goodwill bins, like the clearance center for the Goodwill. But she understands that this is hardly scalable, though she does sort of enjoy the meditative quality of it. In fact, I haven't seen her in a few weeks because she's just been holed up doing that, if anyone's concerned. Anyway, so Marissa, what are some more large scale solutions for recovering materials and converting them into valuable commodities for global supply chains?
Yeah, and that's really where the rubber hits the road, is looking at how do we create this system at a scaled level so that we can make a dent in the environmental impact and also help improve the social impacts along the way. So, but I have my waste management hat on when I look at this topic. My background is in municipal waste and recycling with the city. So I think of things at that large-scale materials management level. And so in order to get to that scaled approach, we really need robust collection infrastructure that is very convenient and accessible to residents. And our research so far in New York and also nationally through a study RRS just finished, which the center was also a part of, and also with Fashion for Good, which is a global innovation platform looking at scaling technologies and innovative solutions in sustainable fashion. We evaluated the textile composition of the textiles that Americans generate, and we also looked at consumer behavior around their behaviors around disposal and diversion and how they make those choices and how often they throw things away. And one of the things we learned there is that people already have access to diverting their textiles. I think over 90-something percent of the population lives within a 10-minute drive of a Goodwill even. And so it's not that the access on the collection side isn't there, it's that we're not educating enough about it. And perhaps we need to increase the convenience around accessing that. But that's the first thing, is that you need robust, accessible collection infrastructure. And then after that, you need a way of aggregating the materials, because at that point, first you want to resell everything that has any life left as it is. That's absolutely the top of the waste hierarchy above any other materials management method. And Goodwill and other charities do a really great job of that, redistributing materials, reselling materials to consumers and local communities. It's about a third, maybe a little less than a third of what they get in donations gets sold to consumers in their local jurisdictions. The rest of it goes through this largely hidden but very well-developed system of sorters, graders, brokers, aggregators, and they all will take the textiles and aggregate them, because at this point it's a volumes game. It's so once you take the reuse fraction out of it, it's a much lower value proposition, so it's all about volume. And they'll sort and they'll grade, and some of it gets exported. And so we need to bolster that collection infrastructure, we need to bolster that sorting and grading infrastructure, especially if we're going to be introducing textile-to-textile recycling, which at large scale does not exist today. Most of the textiles that are traded by the brokers and go through sorters and graders, a good percentage of that still has life in it, about 45%, according to research by the industry association SMART, is good for reuse, and it goes to benefit communities all over the world. And then another portion of that, about 30% of it, is used in manufacturing reclaimed wiping cloth, which is used in industrial applications all over the world, and it offsets the need to produce those wiping cloths from virgin materials. And then you have a mechanical recycling process for the remainder, where it kind of gets shredded up and used inside stuffing for teddy bears and automotive industry and carpet backing and furniture, all sorts of different applications. And inevitably, only 5% is waste out of all of that. And so we need to find a way, if we're going to be doing the textile recycling, to automate the sorting process so it's less labor intensive. And that's really how we build the infrastructure to advance textile circularity.
Yeah. So Marissa just said about 4,000 or 5,000 things in there. So I'm just going to.
Yeah, but you were not. You wanted to weigh in.
Yes, I was nodding on the textile and textile recycling piece, which just to summarize, you know, what Marissa's talking about is at the first, she said education and outreach. So we need to expand, right, these opportunities, let everybody know. The report that we are about to put out, you know, 60% of New Yorkers that were surveyed already are donating their textiles. They're not going into their collection bin, right? They know not to put them in their recycling bin. They're not putting them in their trash. They're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we need to inform and expand, education. And we do that through Recycle Right New York, through our center. We're doing as much education as possible. We have, like Marissa just outlined, you know, this great collection system. We have, I think it was, 4,700, I think, collection bins, Marissa, mm-hmm. in the report. We have 800 thrift centers, and Goodwill has been on the show a lot. There's 10,000 tons of textiles per year being captured in New York State, mm-hmm. right? So there's a lot of material, and yet there's still a huge amount of opportunity for that textile recycling, like Marissa is saying. And the reason, you know, that the challenge there is that, one, it really requires some investment, right? So you need to create facilities that can do this textile-to-textile recycling. You can't just do it with anything. It has to be material that, the buttons, the zippers, all of those things have to be removed to make textile-to-textile recycling happen. And we have to understand the material. Only certain materials can go textile-to-textile. So again, a lot of research has been done, but we need that investment in those in infrastructure. And like Marissa said, there's also the other programs like retail. I think she hit on retail collection, or maybe you did, Jasmine, but there's a lot of other opportunities there. All of this, in order to kind of get that investment, we'd love to see New York State, at least for me, I'd love to see a huge investment come about. There has been investments in certain pieces of the chain here, but we need policy in New York State to do that as well. And we're seeing, Marissa in her work and us with the center do support the idea of EPR. So I'm not sure that we've
explained what that is.
I'm not sure that it's come up on your show before, but EPR stands for extender producer responsibility. So New York State has a number of very active EPR laws already on the books. We have that for electronics. There's a new paint EPR. It was a couple of years. But it's basically the idea that the producer is responsible for the end of life of a product. So in designing that material, whatever it is, that producer is going to or in this case, a brand would design, hopefully, for a product that could be easily reused, recycled, remanufactured, whatever that.
Yeah, I'm seeing that a lot with beauty products more and more, mm-hmm. right? Like with returning the bottles and refilling them. But go ahead.
So right now, I think, and Marissa, correct me if I'm wrong, I think France is the mm-hmm. only, there might be one or two mm-hmm. other countries that have EPR textile laws on the books right now. In New York, or in the U.S., New York and California both had policies that were, neither of them got passed, but both of them have, in New York State, Kavanaugh and Kellis had a draft bill this session for EPR and textiles. And so we'd love to see something like that pass, in that ultimately, it puts some of the onus and some of that responsibility on the brand. And then the brand basically creates they create an organization that figures out how to fund and basically invest in the recycling and the reuse system in this case, it would be New York State.
So put very simply, walk me through what that would look like for the consumer in an ideal world. In your ideal world, what does that look like?
Ideally, it doesn't do anything. The consumer, it doesn't change anything for the consumer.
So it's not the consumer's responsibility?
Shocking. The consumer doesn't have to worry about it.
Wow, okay.
I mean, obviously, we still want the consumer to make smart choices and sustainable choices when it comes to their fashion. But ultimately, the brands that want to sell clothing in New York State would be responsible for this.
How so? How would it go? You know, pardon me if I'm being dense here, but
no.
I do enjoy shopping. So
yeah.
I have a personal vested interest in this.
Yeah. So ultimately, with an EPR policy, right, if something were this, and it takes these bills are they're complicated. It takes a little while to roll out. But ultimately, all of the brands have to create what is called a PRO, so producer responsible organization. They get together and they decide the structure of how in this case, it would be the New York State government would decide the activities such as collection, sorting, reuse, all of the repair and recycling, all of those pieces. They would figure out the structure, but they would have to then pay in basically to cover the cost of the end life of that product. So this is where in the beginning of the conversation when I said it was really innovative, mm-hmm. having accurate data in New York State will guide these brand owners to understand what material we have here in New York State.
Right.
Do you want to add? I'm sure Marissa wants to add some other pieces there. Yeah.
I was just going to say, shall we mutter the term needs assessment?
Okay, needs assessment.
You know, the process that you go through to map out what the landscape is, so you have all the data you need for a producer responsibility organization to put their plan together. So they know what infrastructure is already there. They know what infrastructure they need. And I'll just add on the topic of EPR. One of the really crucial benefits that it provides is it unlocks the financing and the funding to build the infrastructure, which is for textiles especially important, because if we're doing textile recycling, that's a brand new market. That's a brand new industry that doesn't exist yet. And so it's really difficult to get investors to feel comfortable enough investing in solutions when there's no proven business model, no proven marketplace for it yet. So it's very much a chicken or egg situation when you say, oh, well, you know, a brand has a recycled content goal to increase, or a sustainable materials goal or something. They want more recycled content, but there's no recycler that's producing that right now. And the recycler says, well, I would build my facility. I have proven out the technology, but I have no supply because we're not sorting the collected materials in a way that makes them available for the recycling technologies that are out there, which are primarily, you know, they're looking for pretty pure polyester, pretty pure cotton, or pretty pure nylon, or a very specific ratio of poly-cotton blends. Mm. And we make textiles that are just this big, massive combination of lots of different fibers and lots of different buttons, zippers, trims, all those different things, finishes, dyes. And so you have this chicken or egg situation where the industry doesn't have a proven model yet. And so it is very, investors are very risk averse in putting funding towards building that model. And so what EPR does is it guarantees the supply, it guarantees that the offtake is there, it levels the competitive playing field around brands, and brands are able to then build into their bottom lines the cost of raw materials, even if there is a bit of a premium on recycled content at first, but then we expect that to come closer to parity, especially if you were to remove some of the subsidies on the synthetic fibers that exist today, right, and some of the agricultural subsidies on the other fibers as well.
Yeah, I mean, someone has to go first if we're going to do that, right? And I can understand mm-hmm. why this would be a risk And I also understand the need for it. There are some really big problems we're discussing here, and we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about some examples of upcycling initiatives. I want to talk more about regenerative fashion. We're talking about the impact of fashion on the climate. So join me as we chat more with Marissa Adler and Kate Walker when we come right back.
I'm Evan Dawson, host of Connections. We bring you in-depth conversations with newsmakers, with people from all backgrounds and points of view in our community. And it's a chance for you in the audience to join the conversation in various ways. 2 hours every weekday. We're proud to bring you these conversations, and we look forward to joining you next time on Connections.
Welcome back to Environmental Connections. I'm Jasmine Singer. I'm joined today by Kate Walker and Marissa Adler. And Kate, we were just talking about some of the challenges in what you and Marissa were talking about before the break regarding how there aren't necessarily enough of these recycled fabrics. Can you expand on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, when we're talking about EPR, right, and the policy, the idea that it would level the playing field, right, is that right now in the current system, you have all these brands, which, you know, it's fantastic that there's all this consumer pressure, right? So what can a consumer do? A consumer's asking these brands, and brands have moved. We've got Patagonia, you know, all of these wonderful companies that are trying to produce more sustainable material. But oftentimes, you know, as Marissa was explaining that how those materials are made, it's very tough to get a recycled, you know, if you're looking for polyester or cotton, right now there's not enough of that recycled material. So oftentimes a brand that maybe wants to use a recycled fiber can't find it for their product, and they're using a virgin material instead. So again, something like this policy would help hopefully move that needle and move into a more circular economy and help us get some of that material. And again, for New York State, you know, somebody has to go first, but right. On the economic side, right, we can make the case that this is a job creator, right? This is a place, and in our report we'll put out, you know, this maybe 3 to 4 facilities like this would be a huge economic driver and have an incredible social and environmental impact.
And you think that you strongly believe that this is something that can be replicable and scalable and can work?
It has to be.
It has to be. Why?
Well, it has to be at the rate that we're going, right? We need to be able to manage these fabrics, and we need to start really putting them into some sort of a reuse model. Again, we're not going to be able to continue to ship these textiles abroad. They don't want them anymore, right? And also here in New York State, you know, we only have so much landfill capacity, yeah. And that's not what generally New Yorkers want to do. And even, you know, when you started off the show, Jasmine, and you have 4 or 5 bags of donations, we know we have too much as
right.
It is.
Of course. Well, and yeah, I mean, I agree that we need innovation, yeah. Because the problem is, I mean, it's just, we've talked about food before, and to me, there really are so many parallels. Food is everywhere. Clothes are everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I don't even understand how. Every day I probably get hundreds of ads thrown at me for various types of clothes. And I know that the clothes that are being, you know, targeted to me on Instagram or whatever are not ethically sourced in a way that I would be comfortable with, or maybe not aligned with the goals that I personally have for the climate. Mm-hmm. And so what is someone to do? Mm-hmm. That's what I want to talk a little bit about. How this affects the individuals, because a lot of what we're talking about has to do with businesses and what businesses can do. And I think that's really important. You mentioned donating clothes. As you said at the beginning of the show, I talked about how I was donating clothes with the hope that they'll be reused. So can you both shed some light on what actually happens to these donated items and how much of what we donate ends up being reused versus going to waste, Kate?
Yeah. So whether the material is collected in a collection bin at a Goodwill online. Most of these materials, as Marissa mentioned, are going and being sorted. A lot of our material, what we found in New York State, that sorting is already happening outside of New York State. So a lot of things are being shipped outside. And again, for a small percentage of those materials, we're able to do that textile-to-textile reuse, which we're talking about, putting that material into things like, cleaning scraps or cleaning fabrics and other materials. But then a large amount of them the ones that aren't going to be reused, right, mm-hmm. in those Goodwills and all of them. The kind of final piece of that is either the material is headed to landfill or incineration, okay. or, like we said, being shipped to those international markets.
I don't like this yes. at all.
Yes. Which,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Go ahead.
I would love to take this one as well and weigh in. So consumers, the number one thing they can do is donate their unwanted textiles and buy secondhand. That's hands down the best thing an individual consumer can do. The textiles that are donated, very, very few of those actually end up going to waste. Only about 5% end up being too wet or moldy or dirty to go into some kind of second use. The vast majority of it is suitable for reuse either domestically or abroad. And then you have that fraction that's good for reclaimed wipe and cloth, and then you have the fraction that's available for either mechanical or chemical recycling. And that could be an open loop recycling process where it goes into other industries or other product applications, or it could be a closed loop textile recycling application. But one of the, I think there's a lot of media right now highlighting the impact of textiles that are exported abroad. And one of the things that I really would love to communicate is that the export of our textiles, by and large, goes towards communities where the populations rely on affordable access to clothing. And also it's an economic driver in communities across the world. And the textiles that the media is showing in images such as the Atacama Desert and parts of Africa. Those, by and large, are not the materials that are being directly imported. Nobody is importing loads of containers and paying for that material in the shipment just to turn around and dump it. There is an actual very lively trade, business oriented trade of those materials, and the issue with where those textiles are coming from is there are some portions that are unusable in the imports, but moreover, it's just that these countries in the global south don't have sophisticated waste management infrastructure like we do here in North America and in the U.S. They don't have managed landfills. They don't have adequate waste collection infrastructure or recycling infrastructure. And so I think the conversation needs to be more about how do we provide support to these countries to help help them manage the waste that is generated after the clothes are sold at market and people are done using them and then throw them away.
Okay.
How do we recapture that instead?
How do we? What are your ideas there, Marissa? Because I think you're making a really terrific point. I mean, you're looking at the kind of global supply here, not just how it affects me. What do you think?
Yeah. And one of my points is that nobody should feel guilty donating their textiles, thinking that they are just kind of the burden of other countries. So, but I think that policy is a great way, and investment from producers and from brands and from government can go a long way in helping. And there's a lot of active NGOs that are in this space working on solutions, and trade associations, the Matumba Association in Kenya and the Ghana Youth Clothing Association are all advocating for open borders so they can keep importing textiles, but they're asking for support in building that infrastructure. And I think policies like EPR can actually indirectly push funding through the recovery value chain into these countries where that need the waste management support the most, in addition to grants and donations and things like that.
So how can someone listening to this who cares about their consumer choices and how that impacts, you know, climate change, how can they make choices, get involved with helping these organizations? Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, so first of all, find our center on the website.
Yeah.
So the Center for SMM, just Google that, you'll find us. And also we have an association, the New York State Association for Reduction, Reuse, and Recycling, that does a lot of this work. So if you're interested in getting more involved in the advocacy and recognizing that textiles are not trash, we can certainly use their support and help there. But also just as a consumer, I know we've talked about it, but I think generally, again, we put a lot on the consumer, right? And yet there are some simple things to walk through when thinking about clothing, right? So just really basic, do you need it?
Right.
If you need it, can you find it? Like Marissa has said, can we find it at a thrift store?
Define need.
Well,
just kidding. I'm just kidding.
No, I get it. I mean, if I'm going to a white party, I have to wear white. And what if I don't have it? Right. Again, if
people listening to this might not know what that means, I just want very briefly say what a white party is.
It's oftentimes a fundraiser where everybody has to wear white clothing. There's many themed parties that may be out there, and a lot of people will purchase items, or even just like for a wedding or a special event, you're buying something.
Yeah.
And if you're buying something for a one-time use already, we used to, and I think there's a number somewhere that the U.S. people in the U.S. are wearing items 7 to 8 times, where it used to be 200 times, right?
Wow.
So again, we're getting sick of stuff really quickly. And so again, making sure that you need it, right? Or that you, if you're going to purchase it, that you're going to hopefully wear it again. But buying that item reused is important. When purchasing the item, making sure that it's durable, right? So choosing something that is going to last, something that is, not designed for fast fashion or designed to wear a couple of times.
So like what would that look like?
Right. So just, actually looking at the item, is it made well? You can tell if an item is, if it's thin cotton and you can tell you're going to wash it 3 times and it's going to fall apart.
Right.
So looking and inspecting the item and making sure that it's durable is really important. And again, even when we started talking about food, right, like looking at the ingredients.
Yeah.
Right. Of looking at what the fabric is made out of, getting curious about, and again, all of the materials that our clothes are made of. Cotton is, it can be very, a lot of pesticides could be going into making that, the impact of large scale agriculture. But, what is your product? What is your shirt made out of? And is it going to last? Is it a mixed fiber? Is it made out of one material? Generally speaking, an item that is 100% of one material, it could be more easily recycled than something that is a blended fiber. So just be paying attention. Not that necessarily, that might change your behavior. It may not. But looking at that item and really understanding if you're going to use it again. And then, I'd say those are your general. And then obviously at the end of life, making sure that you're either sharing that with a friend, donating, and the other piece that we haven't talked about that I'd love to see more is repair options, right? And obviously in the circles that we hang out in, Jasmine, more people understanding and learning how to repair items, right? Trying to get back to, sit with our grandmothers and understand how to put a button back on or fix a hole, right? Like these are the things that we'd love to see more opportunities in our local communities and across New York State for repair as well.
I know that this is a big question that is not an easy answer, but I have been seeing more and more of the kind of big companies, I'll call them fast fashion companies, claiming to make changes. Mm-hmm. And I worry that it's greenwashing. And maybe, but I mean, is it always greenwashing, or maybe they are taking some responsibility? Yeah. Well, how do you know?
So I think, and Marissa can weigh in here too, but I think the biggest thing, if you're this curious about this, and looking at greenwashing, right, the best way that you can tell is to go to that brand's website, right? Go and see when they make a claim, if they are saying that they used a percentage of, say, 50% recycled material on whatever it is, right? Go onto their website and see where they actually provide the data behind that information. If you can't find that in their sustainability report somewhere on their website, it's bogus.
It's funny because
might be working on it, but they don't have proof yet.
Yeah, Marissa, go ahead.
And there's the flip side to that, too. I think traditionally there have been some dubious claims made that are unsubstantiated. But right now, there's legislation around greenwashing, and it's top of mind for brands. And so I think you'd be pretty hard-pressed, especially now and as we move into the future, to have brands making claims that are not based on data and research and substantiated methodologies. And in Europe, there's greenwashing legislation that even strictly regulates the use of certain terms like eco and green and sustainable. And all of this, plus the lawsuits in the US and in Canada that have come out against companies making potentially misleading claims, have really put brands on the defensive, and in some cases it has caused a green hushing. So brands are doing work behind the scenes, but now they are a little too afraid to talk publicly about it. Mm-hmm. But the asterisks are so important on any claim. Like Kate said, I totally agree. Go to the website, read more about it if you're skeptical.
That's Marissa Adler, a senior consultant with Resource Recycling Systems. And I'm also being joined in the studio today by Kate Walker, the executive director of the Center for Sustainable Materials Management. And you're listening to Environmental Connections. We're talking about textiles and clothes today. We have an email from Patrick. Patrick says, wearing clothes only 7 to 8 times, that is the definition of privilege where I come from. Everything I use, including socks and shirts, are worn until they get holes. And even then, I'm still wearing them because I don't want to go shopping. Everybody, come up with a uniform for their occupation and keep wearing it. I like that. I mean, there's a good ethos there. And Kate, I'm just curious. You always look great. Like, tell me about, like, how you make your choices. Yeah. I mean, are you constantly going to the Goodwill? Do you purchase anything new?
I finally got my almost 13-year-old to go to Goodwill with me, and our whole lives have changed since. I tell everybody that talks to me for more than a couple of minutes about this, that during COVID, I did an analysis of my wardrobe just for fun. I had an Excel sheet, and it was like, I think it was 73% of my wardrobe outside of underwear and socks had been purchased, reused, or secondhand. So I do a lot of thrift purchasing at Goodwills and our local consignment shops. We're super lucky here in Monroe County to have places, and I frequent the op shop. I know Joe's been on the show as well, and so I am definitely a fan of reuse, and that's where I find a lot of my items. But to the comment from the email, mm-hmm. not everybody, right? I love that not everybody is purchasing a ton of fashion, and that's great to make things last for a long period of time. I do think, though, that I think in the U.S. and here in New York, especially the fashion capital of the world in New York City, I think it would be hard to make the case for uniforms. I don't know that we're gonna do that anytime soon.
I think I thought of what he meant by uniforms. I thought of it more like, I'll wear like mm-hmm. a button down and mm-hmm. jeans to yeah. work. And I'll get like 3 button downs and 2 pairs of jeans. That was kind of where I went. I'm sort of in my uniform right now, actually. This is kind of what I wear here.
Well, it does take out some of the thought of, right, like, and you've heard like great entrepreneurs, and you've heard from folks that will wear a uniform, like black t-shirt and jeans, right? Many people, it does simplify choices in the morning. But again, I do think, the individuality and we don't want to lose that creativity mm-hmm. that's behind the fashion industry, I think.
We're just about out of time. I just want to make sure that you both are able to give a very quick last thought. So I'm sorry to cut this short. I have like 5 billion more things I want to discuss with you. But Marissa, can you just let us know any final thoughts you have very briefly, as well as how people can get in touch with you or support your efforts?
I'm just really excited about the direction that we're moving in, you know, as a community and as a society and as an industry, towards looking more closely and deeply at these issues and really critiquing how can we make positive change, how can we do it working together. I work a lot with competing brands in pre-competitive environments where they all recognize that there's an issue and they want to solve it and can't do it alone. So I would just want to end on that positive note of optimism.
Love it. And can you tell our listeners your website?
Recycle.com.
Oh, well, that's easy to remember. That's a great URL to get. Someone was very happy the day they secured that one. Kate, yeah. Kate Walker, the executive director of the Center for Sustainable Materials Management. What is your final thought very briefly?
Yeah, similar to Marissa, that for those folks that feel completely overwhelmed by these topics, that just to remember that there's a ton of work happening behind the scenes, you know, investments like our center, but new policies that are emerging. If you want to find us, I'll just wrap it up. Center for SMM, it's Center forsmm.org to learn more about the work that we're doing.
Kate Walker, Marissa Adler, thank you so very much for joining us today on Environmental Connections. My last thought for you all is don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. I'm Jasmine Singer. Until next time, thanks for making today's Environmental Connections.